the topic today is based on some teaching that Lauren has been offering recently. What's the matter? Can you guys hear us? I hope you can hear us. Lauren, do you want to?
Yeah, sorry. I was just hearing something in my headphones.
Oh, okay.
Wasn't sure if how's your headphones?
I can't hear anything. Great. Hi, everybody. So again, this is going to be a call-in show. I'm going to say this number a few times throughout the show today too. 518-828-0290, and right. We're inviting you to call in with questions, anything you want to share, stories on the topic, and also resources. We're going to be sharing some resources for folks today too, but if you have your own that we don't mention, that would be awesome if you could call in. So again, that number, 518-828-0290.
Great. So this is kind of my, a storytelling class, in a sense, about my experiences with HPV, cervical dysplasia, and my path towards healing myself, which had a lot to do with accessing resources and a little bit of self-determination. So should I just go for it?
Awesome. Yes. Great. Welcome to the show, Lauren. Thanks for being here.
So this is my story, like I said, of being diagnosed with cervical dysplasia and then navigating the truths and myths about HPV and cervical dysplasia, cervical cancer, dealing with the conventional medical system, choosing alternative allies, and then my own path to healing. So in 2008, I was an apprentice at Herb School at the Northeast School of Botanical Medicine, and I went to Planned Parenthood for my annual pap exam. And the results came back abnormal. This was the first time that I've ever had a pap exam that came back abnormal. So,
And did you know what that meant when you were told that?
No. Mm-hmm. No. So I had to, but I was told, they had given me a call to mm-hmm. tell me that my results were abnormal mm-hmm. and I had to go back for a colposcopy. So what a colposcopy is, I'm assuming everyone knows what a pap smear is, but maybe we should just give a little.
Yeah, and maybe also, I'm curious too how this was presented to you, like, did they, you know, and how they kind of told you, well, right. you need to do this, or, but right. so you want to explain, it sounds like you were going annually for a pap smear, is that right?
Yep, so doing my whole annual pap routine, and pap smear is a procedure, for lack of a better word, when you go to a gynecologist and they, swab your cervix. Well, actually, that's more of a colposcopy. But basically, they do take, like, samples.
Their body cells, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. And, like, send them off to a lab. And hopefully everything's within normal, range. But sometimes if it's abnormal, then, which they didn't explain anything over the phone. They had just said, like, you have to come back in for mm-hmm. A colposcopy. And what a colposcopy is a procedure where they more closely examine the cervix for cellular abnormalities. And they use this vinegar solution where they put that along your cervix, and any abnormality that you may have will appear as white.
And this pap smear, how often had you been going, and how did you know that you should be coming into uh-huh. the doctor once a year to get a pap smear? How was your awareness around that? Were you encouraged at school, or did your mom?
I think maybe my mom and just like buddies. I don't know, mm-hmm. actually. It's a good question. It was just kind of like,
you just kind of went every year because you thought
that's
you should.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's kind of what in my upbringing, or in my community, was just like what you did.
Mm-hmm.
So this vinegar solution that makes the abnormalities upon the cervix white then allows the doctor to take biopsies, essentially like nick a little part of the cervical tissue mm-hmm. From those white abnormal spots to then send off to a lab for a biopsy.
Mm-hmm.
And just so folks know, It's kind of like an extended pap smear procedure in terms of what it feels like. And then nicking off of the cells didn't necessarily hurt. It was definitely uncomfortable. And afterwards, I experienced some spotting and just like real discomfort. Like I had bad menstrual cramps and I just mm-hmm. like went home and laid on the couch for the rest of the day. But mm-hmm. I just like to let folks know what that's like if they mm-hmm. haven't had a colposcopy before, just to know what to expect. Mm-hmm. So basically that, okay, so then the biopsy came back.
How long did you have to wait for the results?
I think about, I can't remember. Maybe a couple of days uh-huh. or maybe about a week or so. Mm-hmm. And then, so then the biopsy came back and I was diagnosed with moderate dysplasia. So cervical dysplasia means means abnormal changes in the cells mm-hmm. on the surface of the cervix. Mm-hmm. So there's like a range or a spectrum of what that those diagnoses can be. You have anything from mild to cancerous. And or it could be, you know, normal, but my pap smear was abnormal. So obviously that wasn't it. But it was, you know, atypical, mild, moderate, severe dysplasia, and then leading to pre-cancer and cancer. So there's this whole spectrum. And the interesting thing that I wasn't told at the time was that the cellular abnormalities, as they become more and more abnormal, it takes a very long time for that to progress. So I was given this diagnosis of moderate dysplasia, and essentially, and I love Planned Parenthood. I think that they provide great access to folks, but I was essentially now this like red flag to them mm-hmm. where I was pretty much made to feel that I would be getting cancer very soon if I didn't mm-hmm. go ahead and have a surgical procedure that they suggested mm-hmm. I have. Mm-hmm. So anyway, to backtrack.
So they just sort of, they didn't give you any kind of context for what all of this means, and this kind of spectrum of classifications wasn't really demystified. It's kind of like once you enter the spectrum, you're classified as whoo.
Right.
You could get cancer.
Right. Mm-hmm. So to backtrack a little bit. So I came back and was like given this diagnosis and I had no idea what this meant. I mm-hmm. like didn't know what cervical dysplasia was. I hardly knew what HPV was at the time. I was given no information and no resources. And essentially I was just seen as a liability at that point. And I was pretty much told that I needed to schedule what's called a LEAP procedure. And
what's
we can
that?
Talk about that, you know, to ensure that I wouldn't then develop cervical cancer. But I wasn't given any information about how much time I had, if I would, in fact, actually develop cervical cancer, anything at all.
And they just said, book this LEAP procedure.
Right.
That's an acronym, LEEP.
Right.
Do you know what that stands for?
So, yes.
But they didn't tell you at the time.
They didn't. I was given no information uh-huh. and I was like scared and I was nervous and I had no idea what was going on. And then I was being told that I needed to get a surgery that essentially like, you know, cut away part of my cervix, which I didn't think I wanted. It just seemed like a wrong thing to do, but uh-huh. it was because I had no idea, you know, what really was happening. And then in that environment just felt really tense, really nervous, and like not well supported. Mm-hmm. So the LEAP procedure is loop electrosurgical excision procedure. It uses a thin wire loop with electrical current passing through it to cut away cervical tissue.
And do they give you an indication how big a piece of your cervix is being removed? Are we talking an eighth of an inch?
Right. Or like what would that mean? Or what are the risks or anything uh-huh. like that? And also to backtrack, HPV is the human papillomavirus. It's the name of a group of viruses that infect the skin and mucous membranes, which here we're talking about the cervix and cervical dysplasia, cellular abnormalities upon the cervix, which if left untreated over time could develop into cervical cancer. So there's more than 100 strands of HPV out there, most of which are harmless. And of that 100, types of HPV, there are 30 types that are transmitted sexually. Mm-hmm. And then of those 30 types, there are 17 which are considered high risk and may cause these abnormal cellular changes, which then maybe can lead to cervical cancer. So mm-hmm. just for folks out there to get kind of an idea. So a lot of us who are sexually active may have had HPV and not even know it. So I, at the time, had no like symptoms. HPV can develop into some strands of HPV can cause genital warts. But if you don't have an outbreak, then you might not know you have it at all. It's kind of like folks talk about HPV like the common cold of sexually transmitted infections. It's kind of like the cold or flu virus. The infection can be cleared by a strong and healthy immune system, and that's anywhere from 8 months to 2 years that your body can actually rid itself of that virus. But when it's not cleared by the immune system, dysplasia can occur, mm-hmm. which again, if left untreated, and depending on what strain you have of HPV, could potentially develop into cervical cancer. But there's something called the HPV DNA test, which folks can know if they're going to get a pap smear. Some doctors already do that when you're getting if your pap smear comes back abnormal, they'll do an HPV test to find out which strain of HPV you have to see if it's one of these 17 more, mm-hmm. you know, high risk to developing dysplasia. I was not given any information of that test at the time. Mm-hmm. And if I knew that it was out there and I could afford it, or if my Medicaid at the time would cover it, I probably would have gotten it just to have more information. But again, the cervical dysplasia and the potential for it to progress into cervical cancer, again, takes a while to occur. It doesn't happen overnight. We're talking many, many months. Uh-huh. So there's plenty of time to do other, you know, lifestyle shifts and other alternative treatments. Hey, Jane.
Woo-woo! And I think we're going to be talking down the road here in this show today about what some of those will be. Talk specifically about what some of those interventions right. we can do for ourselves are, just when you've been diagnosed testing positive on the HPV test,
right?
To right. make so it doesn't automatically cause cancer,
right? Exactly. And that was one of the really hard things about, you know, working with the nurses at Planned Parenthood. It was just I left so scared and like so unsupported and just certain that I didn't want to schedule this procedure. And it mm-hmm. is a choice. And for some people, it might be the right choice. Mm-hmm. But I think that knowing your options and having the most information is the most important, so that you can figure out what you want to do for yourself. So what I had to do from there is, you know, do my research. And in that time, you know, what I chose to do was reach out. Well, it was first and foremost, like, reach out to everyone that I knew to see if they had ever had this and what they did. And in that time, I got several phone messages from Planned Parenthood continuing to pressure me into scheduling an appointment for this LEAP procedure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think at that point I was just a liability. Mm-hmm. You know, I had this like moderate dysplasia and they knew that they needed to. And they had given me, they had given me like a diagnosis and they had given mm-hmm. me a suggested course of treatment. And I didn't engage in that and I didn't accept that. Mm-hmm. So there I'm just kind of like this hanging red flag for them.
Mm-hmm. And were you able or comfortable communicating with them about the ambivalence you were feeling about the course of treatment they had sort of presented to you? Were you able to talk to them about that at all or get more information from them? Or you pretty much, it sounds like you felt like you had to then go out on your own and advocate right. for yourself.
Yeah, I pretty much, yeah. I mean, I received some compassion there. And there wasn't a lot of information out there about what the what my other options were. Mm-hmm. So I kind of just had to firmly state, you know, I'm not scheduling this appointment, and they just kept saying, well, please keep us, you know, please keep us posted about mm-hmm. what's happening mm-hmm. with your treatment.
So what did you do next?
So what I did next was call upon a, you know, like I said, I cast an email out to a huge net of people. And at first it was a acupuncturist friend of mine at the time had emailed me with a couple of suggestions. And then I just kept doing more and more research. And I'll give you that protocol in a second. But interestingly enough, at herb school at the time, one of the other apprentices was a good friend, Holly, who was in a health collective called the Down There Health Collective. And they had a they had done a ton of research and compiled this zine called HPV. And so Holly gave me that, and that was a huge, huge resource that I used. And that zine is now available at my booth at the farmer's market on Saturdays, and I will put some copies in the Hudson Wellness Collective as well so that folks can access that for themselves. So,
and folks, I'm just going to read one paragraph from the introduction to this zine so you can hear how they kind of present and introduce themselves. HPV and the vaccine are politically charged issues, and the lack of clear information makes it difficult to understand the virus and its implications. The information available doesn't always speak to the variety of situations we are in and different kinds of sex we have. What about the possibility of transmission through oral sex, anal sex, girls with girls, sharing toys, etc.? How might the risks be different for transgendered people? How do we talk in open and honest ways about this topic that affects all of us? How can we approach it with a casual lover in a long-term relationship or in the context of non-monogamy? We want experiences with health that empower each of us, build us, make us feel stronger and more capable. Making this zine has been part of that process for us, and we hope it will be for you too. So that's from the Down There Health Collective. Are they still active in Washington, D.C.? This was first published in 2007, December 2007. So do they have a website actually?
I don't think they do.
I'm not
exactly sure that they're still active right now. But actually, they do make, if you want to read that other part we had talked about, because, you know, the interesting thing about HPV is that most sexually active people have it. And they may have more than one HPV strain. Like we said before, there's 30 that are transmitted sexually. So, and it really is just based on skin-to-skin contact. So it's interesting to think about risk factors because barrier methods can only get you so far. And so, Down There Health Collective has a great great take on what a risk factor is.
What's a risk factor? Again, this is from the zine HPV by the Down There Health Collective. A risk factor is something that increases a person's chances of developing a disease. Some risk factors are based on genetics, such as age, sex, and family medical history. Other risk factors relate to behavior, such as smoking. Some risk factors are created by outside forces but presented as inherent factors by the healthcare establishment. Race and income are often presented this way, when in fact the issues are much more complicated. For example, cervical cancer rates in the U.S. are much lower than in most non-industrialized countries, and within the U.S., immigrants, people of color, and low-income people experience the highest rates of cervical cancer. African-American women are more than twice as likely as white women to die from cervical cancer. Latinas are almost twice as likely as non-Latina white women to be diagnosed with cervical cancer. Vietnamese women have the highest rates of cervical cancer of any group in the U.S. These differences are partly due to inadequate access to healthcare for regular screenings. When dysplasia is diagnosed and treated early, it almost never develops into cancer. If everyone had access to quality, affordable healthcare, cervical cancer rates would not be disproportionately high among people with less privilege. We take issue with the common classification of race, ethnicity, and economic status as risk factors for cervical cancer. Is being African American an inherent risk factor? No, but living in a country founded on racist principles that continue to undermine access to healthcare is one. Poverty doesn't genetically predispose someone to developing cervical cancer, but high insurance costs can make it darn, I just edited for the radio, darn hard to get regular screenings. Unlike the case with some genetically determined health problems, there may not be a biological basis for a group's classification as at risk for cervical cancer. Really, these risk factors stem from the structures created and perpetuated by the government, pharmaceutical companies, the traditionally white supremacist medical establishment, and a complicated web of other institutions that profit from healthcare. We prefer to say that racism, classism, heterosexism, and many other forms of oppression are the real risk factors. Our profit-based healthcare system doesn't fully meet anyone's needs. In this sense, capitalism puts us all at risk. What would you think if your provider listed that among your risk factors at your next annual exam?
I would think they were awesome.
I would think they're awesome too. And again, that's from the zine HPV by the Down There Health Collective.
Right. And the interesting thing too is that once you get diagnosed with cervical dysplasia, it's advised and strongly advised that you get follow-up pap smears every 6 months so that you can have a handle and a sense of how the abnormality or how the dysplasia is changing, whether for the better or for the worse. So again, the potential lack of access could really inhibit you from continuing to get follow-ups.
Mm-hmm.
And the pap smear is the only thing that we have to figure out if we have cervical dysplasia in the first place, because again, there's no other symptoms that we have X amount of strains of HPV in the first place, unless we get genital warts, which is mm-hmm. not necessarily the most common thing. It's actually more common in male-bodied folks, mm-hmm. and there's no actual testing for male-bodied people right now.
Mm.
So.
Mm.
Yet again,
yeah,
we're the ones that have to go through the testing. So again, this is if folks out there have any questions or anything to share up until this point right now, the number is 518-828-0290. Great. So,
and maybe while we're at it, because we're talking about access and awareness, so we're going to give you a couple local providers who do testing, who do pap smears and cervical exams, and they also sometimes offer other cancer screenings. Let's see, the Cancer Services Program of Columbia Greene Counties has a website and a phone number, columbiahealthnet.org, and the phone number is 518-822-8741. You can find local providers throughout Columbia and Greene counties in the towns of Hudson and Catskill and all around. They provide uninsured women between the ages of 40 and 64 with free pap smears and cervical screenings, and if you call them or take a look at the website. There are some other screening services for women of that age range. They also have some services for men's health, prostate cancer screenings, and a bunch of other things. But since today's show is about HPV, we are encouraging awareness of the pap smear and cervical screening. So again, that number, and we'll post this on the Facebook page, 518-822-8741, Cancer Services Program of Columbia Greene Counties. And again, you know, it's interesting just to contextualize, right? A lot of folks, this is presented under Cancer Services Program. So, you know, yes, HPV has the potential to develop into cancer, but does not necessarily mean you are going to get cancer. Another resource, here in Hudson, we have Planned Parenthood, 190 Fairview Ave, 518-828-4675. They have sliding scale fees for pap smears and cervical screenings and a host of other services. And so we have a call, is that correct?
Yeah, we have a caller.
Hello.
Hi. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. This is Corey. I'm just calling y'all because I'm listening to your show. It's so great and so wonderful. Thanks so much for being on the air. And I'm just curious, there's been so much hype since this vaccine came out.
Right.
And so I'm curious if y'all could speak to the vaccine. And I will take my answer off the air.
Because
I have to go, but I'm going to listen.
Okay.
Okay, awesome. Thanks for calling in, Corey.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, well, that's really interesting because in this HPV zine from the Down There Health Collective, they did a lot of writing about the vaccine because in DC at the time, it was becoming mandated for young girls to get the vaccine at around like 11 or so. And other states in the country were having these mandates come up about every young girl getting vaccinated before entering, you know, the school year or something like that.
And let's just, you know, this HPV zine, the title of this chapter is How the HPV Vaccine Shows We Need to Smash the State. So listen up, y'all. So Lauren, so, yeah. Is it still mandatory, the vaccine?
You know, I don't think so. But this is interesting. So, okay, we can do a couple things here. At the time that this was written in 2007, in all 50 states, Merck, meaning large pharmaceutical company.
M-E-R-C-K, yeah, they publish also a lot of... In addition to being a large pharmaceutical company, they fund a lot of research and also even publish some of the educational texts that healthcare providers use in our classes, licensed healthcare providers. Mm-hmm.
And so Merck's vaccine was Gardasil. Mm-hmm. Some folks have had that or heard of that. So in June of 2006, the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, approved Gardasil, a three-dose HPV vaccine that protected against four HPV types, two strains that cause genital warts, and two of the about 15 high-risk strains that can lead to cervical cancer. So again, this vaccine... only protected against four strains. So together, these four HPV types cause 70% of cervical cancers and 90% of genital warts. So that's great. It was approved for girls and women ages 9 through 26, and then was at the time targeted at 11 and 12-year-old girls with the hope of vaccinating them before they became sexually active. However, there was no, any long-term studies done at the time to, you know, consider any risk factors of what this vaccine, you know, had for longer term. It didn't vaccinate against every single HPV strain. So the pap smear would still be a really important thing to do year after year. And the thing about it is that this is what the Down There Health Collective also wrote. At the request of Merck, the Gardasil vaccine was approved through a fast-track priority review process designated for vaccines that have, quote, potential to provide significant health benefits, end quote. This process takes 6 months or less. The vaccine had not been yet tested for long-term safety, and even medium-term studies had only been done on girls over 15 years old. There are only two studies available for review, and both were done by the manufacturer. Studies on girls 10 to 15 years old did not access safety beyond 14 days, and these studies had not been published and are not up for review by the medical community. Who knows if they are now? It's been a couple years. Merck had tested the vaccine on only a few hundred 11 and 12-year-old girls, and the fact that the effects on young girls had not been studied their health collective states was particularly troubling given that the vaccine is being recommended and even mandated for girls as young as 9. And also not to mention that the vaccine, again, as said before, it was three different shots. And each of those shots that you get was about $150 a pop. So very expensive. Not much safety known about. And then there were just like media blitzes all over about this vaccine when it was coming out. So it is pretty controversial because protecting against four of the pretty fierce strains is pretty good. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know. It's hard for me to think about because if you have two strains that could potentially lead to cervical cancer and two strains that could potentially lead to genital warts, safeguarding yourself, but you know, from those things is a good thing. But there are other safeguards. How do we know that this is necessarily a safeguard mm-hmm. if there's not adequate testing done to make sure that the vaccine itself is safe? Mm-hmm. And Merck is just like pushing this through mm-hmm. as quickly as it can. Mm-hmm. And to them, it's like cha-ching, billions and billions of dollars that mm-hmm. they can be making, mm-hmm. mandating, mm-hmm. state mandating that all of these young women be vaccinated.
And also, there's a kind of a false hope that's promoted because right. it's advertised as a vaccine against cancer. And right. that's actually not necessarily true. It is a vaccine against specific strains of HPV virus. HPV is important and a precondition in the development of cervical cancer, but it's not the sole factor in the development of cervical cancer. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's not as if you get this vaccine, you definitely won't get cervical cancer or other cancers, of course, too, right?
Right.
But, the marketing is very sort of, there's a lot of fear about cancer, and it really, the advertising seems to play on that fear right. that people have. Like, oh, I'll get this vaccine and I'll, acquiesce to this kind of mandated, expensive practice that isn't even doing what it's billed as being doing necessarily.
Right. And that's a really good point, because then that's just feeding into really messed up ways for nudging people or urging people to take care of themselves.
And what a priority, right? Like, okay, we're going to prioritize this thing, this really kind of simple focused thing, but nutrition and
right, exactly.
all the other things that we do to take care of ourselves, which we're going to get into shortly.
Right.
Why isn't that a priority? That,
right.
And that's across the board for everyone. Who doesn't benefit from good nutrition and
absolutely
all these other factors?
Because like we said before,
why don't we mandate that?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Right, because with our immune system can clear this virus and pretty quickly, I guess, depending on how you look at it. And also, our immune systems may have cleared this virus. So my immune system didn't clear this potential round of, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. of HPV strain that caused my cervical dysplasia. But who's to say that my immune system didn't clear other strains that I may or may not have had?
Right, right. And viruses also mutate, as we see from kind of the, we have all these flu vaccines every year now, and they have to make new vaccines every year because the virus has mutated. And, so also right. this vaccine's mandated, but what if the virus is mutating? It's
right.
just one avenue of potentially fighting a virus, but so many people are already clearing the HPV virus from their bodies. What's the percentage? Most people clear it the first year, and then within 5 years... What was that figure again?
Well, it's interesting, too, because I said here that, I just wanted to read one more point while you look that up. This is, again, from the Down There Health Collective. They say, the controversy surrounding the HPV vaccine reveals the complicated history of women not being given full information to take control of our health. During a community forum in Washington, D.C. concerning the city council's mandate that all girls entering the sixth grade must be vaccinated against HPV, a nurse and mother of a girl in D.C. public schools powerfully stated, quote, "We women are constantly told that we cannot do anything on our own, from our first menses to menopause. We are sold products, pills, and told to go to doctors for everything. We need to recognize that nutrition and lifestyle are the most important factors in our health, and much of this we can take care of ourselves," end quote.
Yeah, and I guess I'd also, it's so interesting, this vaccine was mandated for young girls, but
yeah.
HPV affects everyone
right.
of all genders.
Right.
That says a lot. And young women what our society would call sexual age or pre-sexual age being controlled by the state.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind mm-hmm. of intense.
And on the top and along those lines, and then I can get into some of the protocol that I use to clear my dysplasia. But I just want to also say that, pap smears are the only detection that we have for cervical dysplasia at this point. And so at a certain point when you have, you've received normal pap smears or you've had annual normal pap smears, once you reach about 30, some doctors then tell you that it's okay to no longer get the yearly pap exam, but to come back anywhere from like 2 to 5 years, I've heard, for your next exam. And so,
and they're basing this on,
right, the fact that they believe that once you hit 30, you're like in a monogamous sexual relationship and all settled down and no longer have to worry about HPV or cervical dysplasia, because they assume you're, you know, getting older and settling down. But that is such, you know, such a crock, because, you know, people over 30, I mean, you know, many people have many different sexual partners, or their partners have many different sexual partners, or HPV might not, you know, dysplasia might not occur from past, you know, exposures to HPV strains. I mean, it's not like you get exposed and then boom, you have cervical dysplasia. I mean, kind of, you know, it could come up at any point. So I just think it's so ridiculous. I mean, I really advise or strongly suggest that people continue to get that yearly pap exam, because it's the only thing that we have. So if your sex partners are changing, or you have multiple sex partners because that's how you roll, you know, how, if you wait 3 to 5 years, well, something could be happening during that time period and you're not, you don't know.
Yeah. So it's just another example of how various isms and biases that we have to, we, on this show, we like to uncover those so that without judgment, you can make an educated decision, because there's basically judgment inherent in this medical decision. Oh, okay. After 30, we assume that you're not sexually active with more than one partner, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
If that's not, you know, if they're not explaining to you the decision-making process and telling you how frequently to get screened for something, that's a problem.
Right. Absolutely.
Also, do we want to, before we go into your protocol, again, you know, this focus on testing and mandates and vaccines, everything's focused on women and telling women what to do. Men are not encouraged to be screened for HPV. Can we talk a little bit about effects for male bodies that HPV has if a person is carrying a strain of HP virus? Is it primarily external genital warts is the biggest health risk?
That
for male
is,
bodies, or
is definitely one that comes up. Most males who get HPV of any type, says the Down There Health Collective, never develop any symptoms or health problems. Some types of HPV, like we said before, can lead towards genital warts, and other types can cause penile cancer or anal cancer. So there is anal pap tests. So for male-bodied folks who do it like that, they can get anal pap tests, and that would be a great thing to do yearly.
I have never heard of anyone being encouraged to do that. Any of the male-bodied folks in my life have never even, you know, my woman-bodied friends talk about getting pap smears, but it's interesting in terms of awareness. Do you know anyone who goes and gets that test regularly?
No.
Yeah, I don't either.
And there's no test designed to find HPV in men. So this is, you know, this is one way that can detect it.
Anyway, so there's a lot of kind of unconsidered and unexamined gender-based power differential issues around this issue, HPV.
Right.
So, but next, maybe, do you want to talk about now the happy story of clearing HPV from your body?
Right. Okay. So, you know, at the time I was really scared because I didn't know how much time I had to try on lifestyle changes and add in herbs. I didn't know how long I should do that for, but I did know that I needed to get tested again or do a follow-up pap smear within 6 months or by 6 months of my initial diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So
how did you know that?
Just through the research.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And then maybe, I'm not sure if I don't think Planned Parenthood had advised me of that. But after doing all this research and kind of emailing out to my wide net, you know, this kind of all the information that came up.
Mm-hmm.
So what I started doing was taking folic acid. Now you can get folic acid anywhere, you know, Duane Reade, CVS, the health food store. It's a pretty cheap supplement. And what happens is that folic acid has an affinity for the cervix, and a deficiency in folic acid may cause cervical cellular changes.
For pregnant folks, too, folic acid supplementation is often recommended to reduce the risk of birth defects in the fetus, too. So it's, you may have heard of it in that context.
Right, right. So, and I just, you know, I just bought a bottle of folic acid and just took the recommended dosage. I think it's about 800 micrograms or micro units a day. I also took a B complex at the time because folic acid in higher doses, or, you know, when taking it as a supplement, it may mask a B12 deficiency. So I just took a B complex along with the folic acid, and I did that once a day. At the time, let me find this here, cutting down on smoking, because smoking has been shown to increase the chance that HPV might move from mild to more severe, and increase the chance of damaged cells being more susceptible to HPV even after treatment. So folks are definitely encouraged to cut down on smoking, and we can use harm reduction approaches to making that more easy. I drank less coffee and added in green tea, which is greatly antioxidative and anti-inflammatory. I still had, I think, one cup of coffee in the morning, but definitely drank more green tea than I ever had before. I started eating a ton of brassica family vegetables. So that's cabbage. I ate a lot of cabbage, a lot of Brussels sprouts, dark leafy greens. These are very detoxifying and anti-carcinogenic. It's a great idea to also just kind of look at what you're eating at that moment. Try to get really good quality foods, in your body.
Are there any foods? You mentioned coffee and smoking as things to avoid. Right. Are there any other foods in particular that you would avoid? Sugar.
Yeah,
sugar,
processed foods. Mm-hmm. Just anything that's just not natural, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, processed foods, you know, diets that are high in sugar. But nothing in particular that I know of besides that category, which I like to avoid anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, indulge in sometimes, but most often avoid. But yeah, I took vitamin C also for a little while. That supports the immune system, is involved in the synthesis of healthy tissue and chemical detoxification. I also tried douching with a strong calendula infusion. Calendula is a beautiful flower that is immune enhancing and anti-inflammatory and has an affinity for the cervix. So I made a really strong tea out of calendula flowers and tried to put it right where it needed to go, but had a little bit of difficulty douching with it. I was using a turkey baster, to be honest, because I didn't know at the time that at like CVS, you can get those hot water bottles that actually have a douche attachment. So I was just kind of like, doing it myself at home. And that didn't quite work. So I ended up just drinking the calendula tea. But that would be, calendula there is a great ally. I made herbal suppositories that I inserted nightly for 3 months. And that recipe is also in this HPV zine. It was created by herbalist Michael Moore and then adapted by herbalist Katie Crabb. And that is a suppository that's based in a vegetable glycerin and gelatin mixture, which allows the suppository to melt more slowly. So you insert the suppository and you kind of line it up right on your cervix, and it has echinacea, calendula, and thuja essential oil, which is a cedar. And this recipe also had anamopsis or yerba mansa, but I didn't have that plant available to me. I had the echinacea and the calendula available, and then I ordered the Thuja essential oil online from Mountain Rose Herbs. And so just over the stove made this pretty easy recipe and created molds using ice trays, ice cube trays, and tin foil. And once they cool, they're very, right, just like, you know, the gelatin, it's very gelatinous. And I stored them in the freezer. They never froze and got hard. They just maintained their integrity. Mm-hmm. And then I hand sewed a couple cloth pads, because overnight they melt, but they, you know, melt the medicine right onto your cervix. I mean, I really believe that these things just totally healed me.
Were they comfortable?
They weren't uncomfortable. They were like a little funny at first, getting the hang of inserting them. They kind of like flop around a little on your finger, and you have to like insert it all the way up. So it, you know, it took some getting used to. The only thing that was a little uncomfortable, which is why I made the cloth pads, is that, you know, in the middle of the night, as they start to melt, you know, your internal body temperature is melting them, they drip. And so I would wake up in the night with some kind of, you know, sticky stuff dripping down. And that was a little uncomfortable, but not that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. 3 months is a long time. And these suppositories are recommended for, you know, 3 to 6 months. And so I did 3 months, and it's, I think I only had to make 2 rounds for myself. I was able to make enough to last that long of time. And they travel well. So you can, you know, put some, wrap your tin foil up, keep them in the tin foil, and then wrap them up and put them in a Ziploc bag, and they can last a good long car ride until you can put them back in someone else's freezer. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, it was a little challenging, but pretty easy. And the other thing that I did was take an adaptogenic tea blend. So adaptogens are a classification of herbs which help the body to adapt to stress, support normal metabolic processes, and restore balance. They increase our body's resistance to physical, biological, emotional, environmental stressors, and they offer increased resistance to pathogens and infection by building up the immunity. They help regulate and support the neuroendocrine and immune systems. Some are immunomodulating, meaning they have ability to modify or regulate the immune function. So they're just really amazing classification of herbs. They just are tonics that, you know, taken every day over time, just deeply restore us back into balance. The ones that I chose were reishi, which is a mushroom. It's an immunomodulator. It strengthens the immune system. It improves adrenocortical function and relieves stress. It's antiviral, antioxidant, and a nervine, meaning that it helps nourish the nervous system. I also used astragalus, which is a root. It's antiviral, anti-inflammatory. It's also an immunomodulator. It enhances and stimulates immune function. And lastly, I added licorice, which is a root that also enhances the immune system, is supportive of our adrenals, is antiviral, and also an immunomodulator. So I would make a huge batch of tea and cook it on the stove and take about 1 cup 3 times a day for about 3 to 6 months. So those are the things that I did.
And you did the suppositories for 3 months. Right. Did you do the tea for 3 months?
Right. This at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then like at 3 months, I was like, okay, I need a break. You know, my body was just that rhythm. It's a long time. You know, I just like kind of needed a break. So, but, again, so then, okay. So I did all of this stuff for about 3 months, maybe the tea a little bit longer. And then I left herb school. I was done with my program. And I moved back to Brooklyn, where my home was at the time. And with a different health provider, I went in for my follow-up. pap smear. And at the time I went to a community health center that is very queer and trans friendly, you know, was pretty well known in my community for being awesome. And so I went there and ended up having a gynecologist who was also an acupuncturist. So what I want to highlight here is that I made sure when I left Planned Parenthood and left the town of Ithaca where I was living at the time, I made sure to go back to Planned Parenthood and get copies of all of my records so that then the next provider that I was working with could understand exactly what was going on, because it was hard for me to even wrap my head around what all of the all of the, you know, terminology was. So I brought her, I brought my next provider or practitioner all of the paperwork, and then I told her explicitly what I had done. And I tried really hard to be confident and just stand my ground. I mean, immediately walking into the doctor's office, I felt vulnerable and nervous and scared. And so she just looked at me and was like, okay, all right, so let's, you know, give you another pap test and see what happens. So I got a phone call from her about a week or so later. And you know how usually you don't get a phone call if the pap test is normal. Well, she called and said that the pap test came back normal, but she didn't believe it and wanted me to come back for another colposcopy, where I was just like, oh, man. So, but at the time, too, I was like, wait, if she doesn't believe it, maybe I shouldn't believe it. And wait, like, it says it's coming back normal, but what if that's wrong? You know, it was just like immediately I second guessed myself.
So are you, I'm guessing maybe we're considering the fact that because you had treated yourself,
right,
you had used a diagnostic test from a doctor, but didn't go with the treatment proposal they suggested to you. Instead, you treated yourself. So this other doctor who maybe felt pretty sympathetic still couldn't quite believe that your DIY self-treatment had in fact worked.
Correct.
And wanted to then have you go through another procedure.
Right.
To prove to her that perhaps her bias was incorrect. And on that note, I just want to give a shout out too. Did you know that actually there are women who don't go to a doctor for a pap smear or cervical exam. You can do exams yourself. You can learn how to do that. You need a speculum, a mirror, and a flashlight. I'm just going to give a couple websites that have suggestions. There's www.sisterzeus.com. And there's an organization that trains. You can sort of get a training, or you can help each other with your friends to give each other pelvic exams. And that's Hesperian, that's hesperian.info.com. A pap test is a little more difficult to learn, and you need access to a laboratory. But even so, if you don't want to go to a doctor per se, there are well woman midwives and nurse practitioners who can also perform pap smears and cervical exams. So you know, there are people who don't want to go to a doctor, you do have some other options too for the exam.
Right. So then I just wanted to say that when I got the colposcopy, you know,
the second time.
So she's using
the new
this
doctor.
Vinegar swab to, like I had said before, you know, the vinegar solution when swabbed, then any cellular abnormality on the cervix appears as white. I didn't have any. So she finally was able to tell me that what I had done worked, which was great. And then she let me know that she was an acupuncturist, which I didn't know when I first met her. And she had said that she heard or had read that turkey tail mushroom was specific for HPV, but I never actually, I should look into that more. I didn't look into that at the time because I was just like, sweet, I'm done. So then I still went and got pap smears every 6 months.
For how long?
I think I had at least another three. They all came back abnormal. And then I was advised that it was okay to then get the yearly exam. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, I've had...
They all came back normal.
Okay. Yeah. Did I say abnormal? My bad. No, they all came back normal.
Just checking.
I've had normal pap smears ever since. I'm actually due for one now. So I need to go back. But and then I was also told, you know, I'm 33 now. And I was also told at one point that because I've had normal pap smears for a while now, that I didn't have to get them every year and I could, you know, come back every two or so years. But again, I just want to stress that if folks do have changing sex partners, it's probably best to go, you know, if you choose to go get pap smears, to do that every year.
It's not, it's not a bad idea to be familiar with your own body, whether right. that's you looking yourself or having someone else who has a lot of experience with a lot of bodies. It can be a helpful thing, just like checking in with a friend about any other thing. It's a good thing to know your body for preventative reasons, if you want to think about it like that, but it's also a nice thing for yourself to yeah. We live in our bodies, you mm-hmm. know, and when we go through public school education, I mean, we learn about math, we learn about grammar, we might learn about some things, but we live in a body, and a lot of folks don't even right. really know how a lot of things function.
It's
myself
true.
Included, I'm right. a healthcare provider, and I still am always learning new things. Oh, that's how the liver does that.
Right.
It's amazing.
Right, right, so. Right.
I have some more
sure.
resources, but it's...
And also, if anyone out there, we have a couple more minutes left on the show. If anyone out there listening has any questions, give us a call, 518-828-0290. Or if someone else wants to share their own story, I taught this class 3 times so far this summer, which is great. But, you know, just real quick, at one class towards the end, this one really great woman came up to me and said, you know, I was diagnosed with more severe dysplasia. She had the precancerous dysplasia,
mm-hmm.
So about 2 steps above where I was at, and so she didn't have cancer yet, it was precancer. Mm-hmm. She mm-hmm. she really needed to figure out what she was gonna do, and her gynecologist, she had a private practitioner, or whatever you want to call it, you know, had health insurance, and she was working with a gynecologist who later brought in another doctor, and she was actually pressured into having a hysterectomy.
Wow.
And so that is just, you know, that is just, to me, she was terrified and decided that she needed some time to think about it. And because she hadn't gotten back to the doctor's office within a 2-week time period to schedule it, they dropped her from their care. So then she was left to just figure out what to do on her own. So
wow. Wow. I just want to contextualize that a little too, just because I can't help thinking about just all around the world, all the ways that often folks are pressured into controlling our bodies or having our bodies controlled
right.
by people older than us. This is one example, female genital mutilation, male mm-hmm. genital mutilation, and things called circumcision. There are a lot of things that people normalize, and
right.
maybe not everyone agrees that that's always the best way to go. So just
right.
to think about that in your own healthcare decisions and decisions
yeah.
you might have to make for someone else on someone else's behalf, whether that person's a dependent
right.
Youth or an older person.
Mm-hmm.
Can be profound.
Which brings up a great point real quick, is to just, you know, remember that you have the right to get all of your answers or questions answered. And so, you know, at the time I didn't even know it was happening, and I was so shooken up by the initial diagnosis and like kind of the energy in the room and like the pressure that I was feeling to schedule this appointment, that I didn't even know what it was for or what the risks were or anything like that. And it's sometimes really hard to advocate for yourself when you're in a position of disempowerment. And so, you know, it's really amazing now to think that in hindsight, you know, whether it was prepping myself or asking someone to come with me, to just make sure that, you know, all of the questions that I have are written down and are asked to the doctor that I'm working with, and that I stay there until they get answered. So just a reminder to folks that, you know, just because doctors often don't have a lot of time to work with each individual patient doesn't mean that we can't then demand it.
Yeah. The internet is also an excellent place to get some information if you're looking for other people's experiences and even clinical information from government institutions is available online, like the National Cancer Institute is www.cancer.gov. The Gay and Lesbian Medical Association, which also has transgender health resources, that's glma.org. What are some other ones to give you guys? There's studies about HPV in particular that you can find online. This is a really long URL, so I'm not going to say it. But if you go to cancer.gov, you can actually also just read for yourself clinical studies to find out, you know, because sometimes you hear the word cancer, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. It can sound really scary. And so, you know, my advice too is if you're feeling fear and pressure into getting a procedure, just ask around, ask other folks, look for some alternate, you know, or mm-hmm. affirmation if everyone's mm-hmm. agreeing about, mm-hmm. oh yeah, this seems like a good plan of action, you know, but right. don't just, you know, take one experience and kind of feel pressured into doing something.
Right. Well, that's all the time we have for now.
Awesome. But
thanks, Corey, for calling in, and thanks
Lauren,
everyone for listening.
Sharing so sure. much about your own personal experience too. Yeah. As always, folks, if you have some stuff you want to share with us for future shows, find us on Facebook is usually the easiest way, or you can pop a note through the door at Hudson Wellness Collective, 514 Warren Street. And thanks so much for listening.
We'll see you next month, the fourth Thursday of every month from 2 to 3 p.m. Take care.
Be well.